The Big East Conference will be well represented at this year's NCAA men's basketball tournament. The Big East could send a record 11 teams to March Madness. NPR's Mike Pesca tells us what makes this conference so good.
Every league except the Ivy plays a conference tournament, and every conference except the Great West automatically earns its winner an invitation to the big dance. This means that 37 teams must appeal to the goodwill of committee members to qualify for an at-large bid. They may qualify by dint of their records or glint of their coaches' smiles, whatever little bit helps. This year, 10 non-automatic qualifiers could come from one conference, the Big East. Some are questioning how one conference can supply more than a quarter of the at-large teams. Oliver Purnell, who coached at ACC school Clemson before becoming a head coach in the Big East, says no one should look askance at the quality throughout his new league.
Yeah, I don't think there's much of a question that the Big East, you know, should have 11 teams in. As I've observed college basketball the last 25 years or so, it's the deepest league that, you know, I've ever seen.
Purnell should know his DePaul Blue Demons lost to every team in the league except one. They were last, but even the Big East's second worst team, the University of South Florida, was pretty good. They won't make the NCAA tournament, but they set off this celebration when they staged an upset in the first round of the Big East tournament by defeating Villanova, a team ranked in the top 10 as recently as a month ago. The University of Connecticut's Jim Calhoun has won 300 Big East games in his career. He says this season has been among his toughest.
I've never seen it where every team can beat you. And I truly believe every team in this league can beat you. And that's we may not ever see that again. I mean, we have really, really good teams, but everybody's had to work for every win, every point, everything they've done. I've never seen that in 25 years.
Calhoun calls the Big East a meat grinder. Marquette coach Buzz Williams might add tenderizer, pulverizer, and pressure cooker.
It's in addition to the depth of the league, it's the depth of the talent on each of those teams in the league. And that's what grinds you up, and that's what wears you out. And you age, and you gain bad weight, and you have trouble sleeping as a coach.
And Williams is a coach who will be making the NCAA tournament. But Ken Pomeroy, perhaps the premier college basketball statistical researcher in America, points out that while every Big East game is a battle, it's also an opportunity.
Just to say that a team in the Big East, you know, has six or seven quality wins, you can't look at that in a vacuum. I mean, they have 15, 20 chances maybe to get a quality win.
Pomeroy does think the Big East should get 10 and maybe even 11 teams into the NCAA tournament. And while that might seem like a questionable concentration of wealth, consider this. The Big East is the only major conference that was designed with basketball in mind. As the Big Ten, for instance, has expanded to 11 and soon 12 teams, they do so for the sake of football. But the Big East has bulked up to 16 teams with additions like DePaul and Marquette, which don't even play Division I football. And by the way, 16 teams.
They have more darts to throw at the dartboard and hit the bullseye with.
I told you Ken Pomeroy was a statistical genius. The Big East will set the record for most teams invited from one conference. It should be noted that the teams currently in the Big East sent 10 teams in 1989. Those teams did well, winning a combined 16 games, a record that will be hard to surpass, if only because with so many teams in the tournament, if they do well, they'll eventually have to play each other. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. NPR's board of directors ousted CEO Vivian Schiller last night after a series of damaging episodes. NPR's David Folkenflik reports that the move comes as momentum grows among conservatives to eliminate federal funding for public broadcasting.
Yesterday, conservative activist James O'Keefe III posted surreptitious video that captured NPR's top fundraising executive, Ron Schiller, saying NPR would be better off without federal funds. Schiller also sharply condemned conservatives and the Tea Party. Ron Schiller was already leaving NPR for a job in his Colorado hometown, but his departure was made immediate, and NPR condemned his remarks. It was not enough. Last night, NPR CEO Vivian Schiller lost her job, too. The two Schillers are not related. Dave Edwards is the general manager of NPR member station WUWM in Milwaukee, and he's also chairman of the NPR board.
as we looked at the situation that was unraveling now, while the board felt very confident in what Vivian has accomplished, we felt that the series of unfortunate events that have since occurred have now become such a distraction to the organization, and we felt that that hindered her ability to lead and represent public radio.
Those distractions began in October with the firing of Juan Williams for remarks on the Fox News channel about Muslims. That triggered an outcry from conservatives and some journalists. In January, the board rebuked Vivian Schiller, and the top news executive, Ellen Weiss, resigned. The House of Representatives shortly after voted to strip all funding for the federally chartered Corporation for Public Broadcasting, starting in 2013. Yesterday, NPR became a political target once again. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor is a Virginia Republican.
The statements were that NPR realizes it doesn't need taxpayer funding. That's what the statement was about. And so perhaps the truth finally came out. And we are going to proceed along those lines because that's what was said and indicated by that organization.
Ron Schiller did say that some member stations would go dark if federal money disappeared. Officials have estimated as many as 100 would shut down. That fear has driven everything. Here's Vivian Schiller earlier today.
The organization is under tremendous pressure right now in the face of the federal defunding threat and the political consequences of what happened yesterday were pretty great.
Schiller praised the organization's journalists and said she accepted the need to leave as a way of helping public radio get past the current controversy. In her 2 years at NPR, Schiller set out a new collaborative path for the broadcaster and its member stations for an evolving digital age. She also helped NPR emerge on firm financial footing from the recession with deep but targeted cuts. And audiences are continuing to grow. Last fall, a record number of listeners tuned in to NPR shows each week in the nation's largest markets. But some at NPR found Vivian Schiller's leadership under fire wanting.
We have not been well served by recent management. Many of our managers are talented and solid, but others have not been and have exposed us to some terrible, terrible hits.
Special correspondent Susan Stamberg is often called a founding mother of NPR. She has been with the network just shy of 40 years.
The work that we do has been so consistently extraordinary. The strongest news organization in electronic broadcasting, and that has been untarnished. So that's the thing that I'm just trying as a long-standing staffer to keep in my mind and keep focused on.
Top NPR lawyer Joyce Slocum is the interim CEO, but she won't be a candidate for the job permanently. She said federal funding was vital, relying on an analogy used by Vivian Schiller earlier this week at the National Press Club. Public broadcasting, Schiller said, was like a sweater. Pull at a thread, and the sleeve comes off. This afternoon, a White House spokesman said President Obama still supports federal funding for public broadcasting. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
Next, we'll hear about the largest showcase for Asian American and Asian films in the U.S. The annual San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival starts today. The public can look forward to more than 100 films, along with music and digital and interactive media. The festival is welcoming a new director this year, Musashi Niwano, and he joins us now to tell us more about the festival and why he wanted to be part of it. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This festival is almost 30 years old, as this is the 29th. So can you just tell us, how did it get started?
The San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival is presented by the Center for Asian American Media. The Center for Asian American Media has been around for 30 years now and is one of the largest and oldest organizations for Asian American media. And it started really to confront the lack of representation or the negative representations in Hollywood. And since there, we've grown and we're now a great space for Asian American filmmakers who are looking for funding, who are looking to showcase and distribute their films.
What can people who are lucky enough to get to attend look forward to? And is there any particular theme to this year's offerings?
The great thing about a film festival is that we have over 150 special guests. We have comic book writers, we have female comedians, and just all different types of artists. People who come to the festival not only get to see amazing films, but they get to engage with filmmakers. And although they're Asian American, they're making films all around the globe. And sometimes the story behind the film is as interesting as the film itself.
The opening film kind of speaks to your point that the festival is actually global now. Tonight's opening film is called West is is West, and it follows a multi-ethnic family from the United Kingdom to rural Pakistan. The father is introducing his son to daily life in Pakistan. I'll just play a short clip, and then you can tell us a little bit more about the film. Here it is. Sure.
A father must go the distance to show his son another way.
You be respectful all the time.
And they're about to discover this is no place like home.
I need the bug.
Help yourself.
Well, that's obviously from the trailer. So tell us a little bit more about the film.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, West is West is the sequel to the 1999 film East is East and stars the legendary Om Puri. And the child in the film, or the kid, is played by Akib Khan, who will be in attendance at our festival. And it's an amazing film. It's charming. What we really like about it is that it deals with a lot of issues that we deal with within our communities, which include immigration, mixed-race families, generational issues, and assimilation in different countries.
Well, it's also kind of one of those classic coming-of-age stories that a lot right. of people will recognize no matter what their background. I mean, the boy is bullied at school. He suffers right. from teen angst. He's, you know, a little bit of a jerk. I mean, come on, teenager. And he rebels by shoplifting and is arrested. And his father mm-hmm. decides that the only way to kind of get this straight is to take him back and introduce him to his roots. It's got everything. It's got the quest. It's got the father-son story.
Yeah, it has all of that. And it's a funny film. I'm getting jaded when I go to theaters, and this is one of those films where I was just laughing and almost falling on the floor. It's just a really funny film, and definitely recommend people go out and see it.
And here's another film that's considered a hot ticket. It's called Clash. Mm-hmm. It stars mm-hmm. two of the biggest actors from Vietnam. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
Clash is our centerpiece film, and it's playing on Sunday, and it stars Johnny Tri Nguyen and Veronica Ngo, who are two big Vietnamese actors who will be coming in from Vietnam, and it's a big, splashy action flick. It has some kick butt females in it, which I love.
Okay. But who do you think will most enjoy the festival? Is it the film buffs?
We really do program for as many different types of people as possible. So we do have, you know, romantic comedies from Hong Kong, and we have these action flicks and revenge films from Korea. But we also have bold and refreshing documentaries and Asian American narratives. So our audience is very diverse. And so when we're programming, we do have the film buffs who come every year, and it's our challenge to bring films that they're going to love, but also show films that they're going to be surprised that they love.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the 29th annual San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival. It starts today. It's the largest festivals of its kind in the country, and we're speaking with festival director Masashi Niwano. This is his first year directing the festival. So tell me about yourself. How did you get started in film, and why did you want to be a part of the festival?
When I was in college, I took an internship at the Center for Asian American Media, and so my big job for that summer was to archive all the films, Asian American films, that played at the festival till that point. And just seeing over the 500 films, I just fell in love with Asian American cinema, and I just didn't know how rich and how many stories there are. And after that internship, I moved to Austin, Texas, and I was the executive director of the Austin Asian American Film Festival. And I got my film degree, so I'm still an active filmmaker. And when I make films, it's very similar to the mission of the festival, just celebrating our unique stories.
You know, we just heard from a filmmaker who is African-American who mm-hmm. expressed both a sense of frustration about the difficulties of getting these films in front of the public, but also a lot of excitement, just joy and happiness at the amount of talent that is out there. For example, she said that this is both a state of emergency and a Harlem Renaissance moment is the term that she used. What about you? On the one hand, it seems to me that we're seeing Asian-American actors and mm-hmm. people both in front of the camera and behind the camera, both in film and on television. There was a person of Asian American background who was nominated for an Academy Award, I think, for cinematography this mm-hmm. year. But on the other hand, people still feel like this is all we get.
Right.
So what is your sense of kind of how Asian Americans are faring both in front of and behind the camera?
There are more visible Asian American characters in the media landscape, from television to film, and there are more Asian Americans behind the camera. However, I would also say that, you know, it's an interesting space because although you have more representations, you still have to be critical about what these representations are and who's writing these stories. And I know that when I watch television or watch films and I see Asian American characters, there is still a disconnect for myself. I don't feel like these are our authentic stories.
What do you hope to bring to future festivals? What stamp do you think you will put on this enterprise?
What I could bring to the festival is more ways of engagement with audience members. People are consuming media in different ways. So this year, one of the interesting things that we're doing is a multi-screen package. So people who want to see these films, they can go to our festival and engage with the filmmakers. But if they're not able to attend, they can go to our website, cammedia.org, and they can actually see some of the short films for free on demand. So I think it's new ways of engagement, of getting our stories out there, and also more live events. A lot of times people can see films easier or more easy these time right now through YouTube and other forms. And so it's our job as a film festival to have exciting events that people will want to see the films, but also have an experience.
Musashi Niwano is the festival and exhibition director for the Center for Asian American Media. He's the director of this year's Asian American Film Festival. The center is presenting the 29th annual San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival. In San Francisco, it starts today and runs through March 20th. And Musashi Niwano was kind enough to join us at this very busy time from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you want more information about the festival, we'll link to it on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on the program page, then on Tell Me More. And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Grant Clark, Bridget DeShagas, Lee Hill, Kyle McKinnon, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Veronica Miller, Emily Oxenschlager, Amita Parashar, and Amy Ta. Our intern is Rachel Otwell. Our editor is Devar Ardalan. Our directors are Arjun Hutchins and Monica Evstatieva. Our senior producer is Alicia Montgomery. Our technical director is Kimberly Jones. She had a hand this week from Vince Muse and Charles Thompson. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. The executive producer is Tashima Walker. And remember, to tell us more, you can always go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can also follow us on Twitter. Just look for Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Today in Florida, the space shuttle Discovery made a safe return from orbit and landed for the last time. Here's NASA commentator Josh Byerly as the shuttle rolled down the runway.
And to the ship that has led the way time and time again, we say farewell, Discovery.
It was Discovery's final flight, leaving NASA with just two more missions before it retires the space shuttle fleet for good. NPR's Russell Lewis reports from the Kennedy Space Center.
Shortly after Discovery landed, the six astronauts walked out and surveyed the massive ship. Discovery first flew in 1984 and has completed more missions than any other, 39. It was the third flight aboard Discovery for Commander Steve Lindsay, who says he's amazed by the craft's great condition.
And if you think about a vehicle that's 26, 27 years old, been flying for that long, to come back perfect, I have never seen an airplane be able to do that.
Even senior NASA managers concede the ship could fly again and again. Bill Gerstenmaier, Associate Space Operations Manager for NASA, says that's not an option, and it's not the end. The agency has to launch Endeavour next month and Atlantis in June.
We've got two more flights. We need to keep the focus on those flights and stay diligent and keep working those flights just as hard as we did this flight.
Gerstenmaier says spaceflight is never routine. He pointed to the failed launch last week of a climate satellite that never made it to orbit after its launch from California.
Spaceflight doesn't come easy, as we all know. I think last week we got a chance to see that with the Taurus XL and the Glory mission, that things that are even fairly simple to us and we think we fully understood, we obviously didn't understand.
Now that Discovery will no longer fly to space, NASA plans to do an autopsy of sorts, stripping the shuttle down and peering inside to see how parts of the craft have held up after dozens of flights. Again, Bill Gerstenmaier.
So we're going to take really the best of what we got here, learn as much as we can from this, archive it, so then when we go build the next generation, we'll actually have really learned everything we can from these vehicles.
Still, NASA employees have begun to deal with what it means to wind the shuttle program down. Launch Director Mike Leinbach says the end is difficult.
Walking around listening to the comments that the people were making, pretty much all heard that what a great ship this is. Can't believe the program's coming to an end yet, but intellectually we all know it is. And so it's kind of a delicate balance emotionally to deal with that.
And Houston Discovery for the final time, we'll stop.
And while Discovery's space days are over, it has one more flight to take atop a modified Boeing 747, most likely on its way to the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum for public display. Russell Lewis, NPR News at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Most food in America is produced on big farms in collaboration with enormous corporations. It's an efficient system that makes food cheap and abundant. But the downsides, including pollution and allegations of animal abuse, have given American agriculture an image problem. And so big agricultural companies and groups representing farmers are going on the offensive, as Frank Morris of Harvest Public Media reports.
Almost all farmers fret that guys like Eddie Foster, standing on his family's operation in Montgomery County, Missouri, are a vanishing breed.
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid, everybody had hogs in the county, and now there's about two of us left that are independents.
It used to be that most Americans had some connection to the farm. Now, only 1 in 1,000 of us grow 85% of the food. For decades, the best farmers could do was to hang on and adapt. As their political and economic clout withered, federal subsidies kept them afloat. These days, farmers are making very good money on everything from corn to cows. But as Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack warned a group of farm broadcasters meeting in Kansas City, Congress could change all the rules next year when it takes up the Farm Bill.
And you're going to have folks from cities making decisions about the Farm Bill. You better talk to them.
Because city folks are hearing a lot about agriculture these days, and not a lot of it is good.
The industry doesn't want you to know the truth about what you're eating, because if you knew, you might not want to eat it.
That's a trailer from Food, Inc., a documentary depicting inhumane treatment of animals and general disregard for human health in agribusiness. Margot Baldwin, president of Chelsea Green Publishing, says Americans are ravenous for this type of reporting.
When you have books about it becoming bestsellers, so Barbara Kingsolver, Michael Pollan, Eric Schlosser, suddenly it becomes highly, highly visible.
Many farmers worry that most people get all their information about agriculture from foodie advocacy. So Big Ag is fighting back with paid advertising.
Few other industries have shown such efficiency and respect for the environment. So when you ask, who's caring for the land? Look to the people who live on it and make a living from it. America's farmers.
This spot is funded by the seed and chemical giant Monsanto, where Mark Holton is in charge of global corporate marketing.
We're telling the story of the American farmer, and we're using iconic images, which, you know, these aren't actors. These are farmers.
It's not just Monsanto. Several other agribusiness companies are mounting remarkably similar campaigns, and 24 of the biggest ag trade groups have joined the fray, putting aside bitter disputes to form an unprecedented coalition. It's called the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. Hugh Whaley runs it.
We want the general public to feel totally safe in their decision-making process and totally comfortable about the food they buy.
Whaley says they'll do it by showcasing real farmers and ranchers. Cattleman Fred Stokes finds that a little odd.
today, the farmer and rancher don't have an image problem.
Stokes says it's big agribusiness that has the image problem, seeing groups aligned with it, united ostensibly to help family farmers.
It's a little like seeing a gathering of mafia dons smoking their long green cigars, putting out the cover story that they're gathering to build a convent.
As Stokes sees it, the good image farmers and ranchers enjoy is being exploited by soulless ag conglomerates. But Mike Mattson with the Kansas Farm Bureau says this rancor has to stop.
We have seen that this trend line toward, you know, sustaining the political will to do the same thing is not as strong as it's always been. And at some point, we'll reach that tipping point, which is why it's so important for farmers and ranchers to get involved.
And they are getting involved, as never before. Many believe it's the best hope they have to keep the agricultural system they've learned to live with from becoming even more hostile to the family farm. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.